When it comes time to select a new pope, the choice is made by the Roman Catholic College of Cardinals. Yesterday, Pope Francis named a number of new cardinals, including 15 who will be eligible to vote for his successor. So it was an important choice, and much has been read into the names that the pope chose. Boston Globe Associate Editor John Allen has covered the Vatican for many years. He joins us from Rome. Hi, John.
Hello there, Steve.
Do these cardinals break with tradition in some way?
In almost every way, Steve, the answer to that question is yes. The thing that smacks you in the face about the lineup that Pope Francis announced yesterday is the geographical diversity. Of these 15 what we call cardinal electors, meaning men who have the right to vote for the pope, only one of them is a Vatican official. Only 5 come from Europe. There's no one from the United States. Meanwhile, you've got new cardinals for 3 countries that have never, ever had one before: Myanmar, Cape Verde, and the island of Tonga. There are also cardinals from Panama, from Thailand, from New Zealand. I mean, literally all over the map. And even within countries that are accustomed to having cardinals, such as Italy, Francis bypassed the traditional centers of power, such as Venice and Turin, and gave cardinals to places like Agrigento on the island of Sicily that don't usually have them. So it really is a revolutionary crop of cardinals in almost every sense of the word.
So does that geographic choice reflect the direction the Catholic Church seems to be evolving?
Yes. I mean, Francis is, of course, the first pope from the developing world. I think he believes that he was elected on a mandate in part to make sure that the global reality of Catholicism today, I mean, 1.2 billion Catholics in the world, 2/3 of them live outside Europe and North America. He wants to make sure that that global reality is more thoroughly heard at the senior level of the church, meaning inside the College of Cardinals and also inside the Vatican bureaucracy.
Now, you mentioned the Vatican bureaucracy. You also said that there was only one of these 15 new cardinals with voting power for a new pope who come from inside that bureaucracy. I can't help but recall that it was only a few weeks ago that the pope was talking about problems in that bureaucracy and accusing it of spiritual Alzheimer's. What's he upset about?
Well, and you left out the terrorism of gossip and 13 other spiritual diseases, which Pope Francis charged that the mandarins of the Vatican are sometimes infected. I think what it's about, Steve, is that there's a perception at times that the conversation in Catholicism is a little one way. That is, that Rome speaks and the rest of the world listens. I think what Pope Francis is doing is trying to make sure that it's a two-way dialogue so that the voices of the rest of the world are also heard in Rome. I think that speech to the upper echelons of the Vatican, known as the Roman Curia, which happened just before Christmas, was intended to be a wake-up call in that direction. And the appointments of new cardinals that Pope Francis announced on Sunday clearly moves in the same direction.
Some people will be wondering, if you look at these 15 cardinals, though, and they do express this voice from other parts of the world, are they likely to push the church to the left, to the right, in terms of key issues? Any sense?
Well, I think in many ways it is difficult to draw ideological conclusions from this lineup. I mean, on the one hand, you've got a couple of well-known moderates. The new cardinal from New Zealand, for example, is on record favoring allowing divorced and civilly remarried Catholics to receive communion, which is a very hot-button issue in Catholicism today. On the other hand, the new cardinal from Ethiopia supported a constitutional measure in that country that would ban homosexuality as a matter of constitutional law. So I think in terms of the politics of left-right, it's difficult to draw conclusions. I think this is much more about north-south than left-right, in trying to make sure that the voices of the global church, particularly the 2/3 majority of the church today that lives in the global south, are more thoroughly heard in Rome. What those voices are going to say will not always break predictably according to the terms of American politics.
We've been talking once again with John Allen. He's an associate editor of the Boston Globe and also of Crux, a website covering Catholic affairs. Thanks very much.
Always a pleasure, Steve.
As the new year gets underway, we're hearing about people who have started over or reinvented themselves by choice or circumstance. Today we have a story about faith, lost and found again. We're going to meet a military chaplain who lost the very faith he was expected to embody for his soldiers. NPR's John Burnett reports.
David Peter's life was supposed to be one continuous arc of piety and service. He grew up in a fundamentalist evangelical church in Pennsylvania, served as youth minister, then went to war as a chaplain in the U.S. Army.
They went out the...
This was a firefight in Sadr City, Baghdad, shortly after the city fell to U.S. forces in 2003. Peters got to Baghdad 2 years later and saw things just like this. He was 30 years old, serving as chaplain for the 62nd Combat Engineer Brigade, a unit that built guard towers and repaired roads.
So they were operating all around Baghdad at night, in the streets, in the neighborhoods, and really exposed to an incredible amount of danger.
His duties included administering last rites, grieving with survivors, and listening to soldiers lament their broken marriages back home. After 12 months in a combat zone, it was time for Peters to go home.
I found that going to war was really pretty easy, and it was kind of exciting, and there was a lot of energy around it. But when I came home, I really fell apart emotionally and spiritually.
When he arrived back in Texas, he realized that he had changed. He had symptoms of PTSD, and his own marriage had shattered while he was away at war. His homecoming was not unusual, it turns out. This is former Army Captain Kurt Stein, the signal officer in the engineering battalion who grew close to Peters in Iraq.
The real crisis is when we were deployed, we were always told, you know, when you guys get back, December 2006, all your problems are going to be over. You're going to be a hero. You know, your families are going to be glad to see you. For David and for a lot of us, that just wasn't the case.
Peter says it was his lifelong relationship with God that suffered the most. In fact, the God that he'd taken with him to Iraq, the benevolent deity who loves everyone and rewards the faithful, that concept of God died, along with a whole bunch of brave soldiers. Peters had a hard time even going to church anymore.
The church was asking me to confess my sins when I felt like God had done far worse things than I've ever done.
Yeah. Such as?
Standing by and not really doing much for the world that's full of war and conflict and despair, loss. I looked at my own life and I felt that way. I'd just gotten divorced. I was just really angry at God for disappearing on me when I needed him most.
David Peters wound up working as a chaplain in the amputee ward at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, meeting with veterans whose trouble seemed to dwarf his own, and in the psych ward, where he says, there was a thin line between the patients and me. Off work, his life had imploded. Newly single, he dated a succession of women because, he says, sometimes they can take the pain away. His younger sister, Sarah, visited him in D.C. and noticed a dramatic change.
He was drinking a lot. I just remember him being very angry at people, at just things that were so out of character for him.
Last year, a small veteran-owned press published a slim, anguished memoir that Peters wrote about his journey. In the book, titled Death Letter, God, Sex, and War, he writes, I went into the business of religion to understand death. He says since the book came out, he's gotten emails from others.
Army chaplains who have experienced just real transition like I did when they came home, and yet they were religious people. They weren't allowed to have problems.
And so David Peters had to start over. He had to leave the Bible Fellowship Church that had endorsed him as a military chaplain because he was divorced. He eventually found a home and became ordained in the Episcopal Church. He also remarried. He and his new wife are expecting a child next month.
To start over, to start a new marriage, to start a new job, to start in a new church. All those things took a great deal of just patience.
The trauma of war and divorce deepened his spiritual self in such a way that he can now connect as a priest and chaplain with others who are living through a dark night of the soul. At 39, Father David Peters is today on staff at an Episcopal church in Georgetown outside of Austin. He still serves as a chaplain in the Army Reserve up the highway at Fort Hood. And he started a weekly veterans ministry in Austin that meets to talk, drink coffee, and pray for one another. John Burnett, NPR News.
Now we turn to an organization designed to protect free speech for writers and journalists, PEN. Suzanne Nossel, she's the executive director for PEN American Center. She's also a former U.S. diplomat who worked on issues of free speech around the globe. To talk about some of this and put it in perspective, good morning.
Good morning.
Obviously, a terrible tragedy, but you would have known of this magazine. Would you have thought it to be vulnerable to this?
Well, they were vulnerable. They were firebombed a couple of years ago. It's being reported this morning that they were threatened. You know, they were provocative. They pushed the boundaries. They were fearless. And that's what put them into the crosshairs here. And this is a pattern that we've seen escalating over time. It began with the Danish cartoons years ago. We saw it again with the Innocence of Muslims, that provocative video that sparked violence. But this is kind of a new level of explosiveness and deadliness, you know, right in the heart of Paris.
Well, you speak of a new level, but put this in some perspective for us, a little history. You mentioned the Danish cartoons. Now, you're talking there of images and satirical images of the Prophet Muhammad.
That's right, and those images are seen as deeply offensive to many people of the Muslim faith, and they do regard making images of Muhammad or satirizing Muhammad, you know, as a level of offense that I think is kind of hard to understand as a Westerner. You know, if you speak to them, it's clear that this does strike the heart very deeply in a religious sense. And so that's something that I think is fairly widely understood among Muslims. You know, the idea, though, that it justifies violence, I think, is limited to a small group, but it's not something that's new. We have seen before threats of violence, acts of violence in response to what they see as provocation and incitement, that these images are kind of so incendiary that, you know, in the minds of some, violence is a warranted response.
Although, again, I'm just talking perspective here. Blasphemy is actually illegal, a crime, in some Muslim countries. In theory, punishable at the by the worst punishment. In no way to put this at that level, but it is a very deep-seated negative.
Well, that's true, and blasphemy remains a crime on the books in some European countries. So that idea, you know, is something that's pretty widely accepted, that the offense to religion, you know, in some cases can be criminalized, has historically been criminalized. But in the West, you know, those crimes typically now aren't prosecuted, aren't punished. And, you know, this is also a matter not of a state bringing a prosecution for blasphemy, but individuals taking it into their own hands to commit an act of terror and an act of murder. And I think the overwhelming majority of Muslims, even those who might be deeply offended by these images, you know, realize that that crosses a huge line.
Well, finally, and just briefly, what does this mean, though, for the future of things like, you know, freewheeling satirical magazines and free speech?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, it comes on the heels of the whole controversy over the interview and the threats that may have emanated from North Korea. And it's really hard to imagine movie studios aren't. Now, we know they're thinking twice about provocative movies that insult certain figures. And you know magazines around the world that publish, you know, these kinds of cartoons are going to, you know, perhaps hesitate for a moment, think about security considerations, and that has a chilling effect on free speech and is, you know, really has the potential to undermine some of our fundamental values. So it's a pretty terrifying attack on free speech that, you know, the whole world really has endured this morning.
And actually, just stay with us because I want to bring in my colleague, Steve Inskeep.
Yeah, I have a question for you, Ms. Nozzle. You've given us a bit of a review of some of these attacks up to now. We heard from our colleague, Eleanor Beardsley, who is on the streets of Paris, that there was a policeman posted permanently outside the offices of this satirical magazine. Do you have a sense of how well authorities in various countries have responded to the continuing threat of this kind of attack?
Well, this is something that has seized diplomats and government officials at the UN in places like the Organization of the Islamic Conference, which is a Muslim umbrella organization. They are well aware that these questions of so-called defamation of religion can be explosive, incendiary, and deadly. They've been working on trying to find more kind of compromise solutions, peaceful solutions. But I think this is going to elevate all of that to a new level. It's really, you know, made it so clear how truly deadly, violent, and threatening these attacks can be, and kind of going straight at the heart of speech. You know, we don't even know who's been killed, but we have to assume it's probably journalists, cartoonists, editors. So that's going to, I think, focus the minds in capitals around the world and on police forces around the world about the need for added security, the need for more kinds of alternative approaches like dialogue, responding to speech with more speech, speech that rebuts, you know, more promotion of understanding of where the offense lines and the trigger lines are so that we can deal with these religious differences more constructively.
Okay. Ms. Nozzle, thanks very much.
Thanks very much.
That's Suzanne Nossel. She is executive director of the Penn American Center, talking with us on this day when we are tracking news of an attack in Paris. A dozen people reported killed after at least three men attacked a French satirical magazine. Video shows the men rather calmly moving about, even shooting an additional person on the street on their way away from the scene. We're told that the dead include four cartoonists at this magazine, which had published cartoons which were viewed as offensive by many Muslims, also cartoons that were that offended Jews, offended Catholics. It was a satirical humor magazine, and it has been attacked today. The gunmen drove away and are still believed to be at large in Paris.
The cartoonists at the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo have become targets of this week's attack, apparently because of their depictions of the Prophet Muhammad. Some Muslims find any depictions of the Prophet offensive, let alone the sometimes crude drawings in Charlie Hebdo. But not all Muslims feel that way. Far from it. Earlier I spoke with Reza Aslan, a religious scholar and the author of No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam. Reza, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I've seen and heard conflicting things when it comes to Muslim sensibilities about depictions of Muhammad. You know, there's this sense that it's forbidden. But I know that I've seen historical depictions from, like, classical India showing the Prophet. So what are the rules?
Well, there are no Quranic prohibitions against depictions of the Prophet Muhammad. And even among the six or so authorized schools of law, there's all kinds of disagreements about whether you can and how you can show the Prophet Muhammad. It's certainly a cultural taboo, but that taboo arose organically and through a long period of time, which is why precisely, as you say, the history of Islam teems with thousands and thousands of images of the Prophet Muhammad, from his childhood, various scenes from his biography, all the way really to the end of his life. It's a very common thing that we see throughout Islam's history.
If there are no fixed rules, can you explain the reaction to the Charlie Hebdo cartoons?
Well, partly it has to do with the fact that these cultural taboos have become fixed in the minds of particularly Sunni Muslims who adhere to a puritanical, ultra-Orthodox brand of Islam. So for them, any depiction of the Prophet Muhammad is insulting. But let's be clear, these weren't just depictions of the Prophet Muhammad. They were quite deliberately provocative images of the Prophet Muhammad. They were intended to provoke a kind of response, not a violent response, but a kind of negative response from Muslims in Europe. And in many ways, the editors of Charlie Hebdo would say quite unapologetically that the purpose of these images is to act as a kind of test for Europe's Muslims. Can you bear to have the Prophet Muhammad caricaturized in this way? If you can't, then you don't belong here.
Reza, you and I are roughly the same age, and I feel like I've seen a change in sensibilities and sensitivities over our lifetimes. I think back to the Salman Rushdie controversy in the late 80s. I had a Pakistani friend who said to me at the time, you can buy Dante's Inferno in Karachi, which has Muhammad in the eighth circle of hell with his entrails hanging out, and they ban satanic verses. What's going on?
I think that there is a fundamental source to what has become a kind of virus of radicalism across particularly the Sunni Muslim world. And that source is Saudi Arabia. We have to understand that what we are faced with is a ultra-Orthodox, puritanical strain of Islam that arose in the 18th century, the end of the 18th century in Saudi Arabia, often referred to as Wahhabism, and which became the official religion of the Saudi state in 1932. Over the last 25, 30 years or so, the Saudi government has spent somewhere along the lines of about $100 billion promoting this kind of puritanical strain of Islam across the world. And this Saudi Wahhabism is unique in that it takes this notion of iconoclastic behavior to its extreme. I mean, one of the first things that the Wahhabis did when this movement began is they went around destroying any tomb or any sacred space in Saudi Arabia that was associated with the Prophet or his family. They even tried to destroy the Prophet's tomb itself in Medina. Now, $100 billion buys you a great deal of traction. I mean, at this point, there is really not a Muslim community anywhere in the world that has not been affected by this strain of Saudi Puritanism. And it's created an enormous shift among Muslims towards this kind of Arabocentric, ultra-Orthodox, puritanical strain of Islam.
Reza Aslan is a scholar of religion. His latest book is Zealot. It's a biography of Jesus Christ. Reza, thank you very much.
My pleasure.